Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Salmon on the Columbia and Snake Rivers are disappearing. Some say it's the dams. Others say it's poaching. On board a poacher patrol boat in Idaho, this time on the Environment Show. And disposing of household hazardous wastes. And where does anything come from and eventually go? Developing a life cycle analysis.
As people have begun to use a more holistic view of things, they have realized that a lot of these small localized consequences tend to add up to broad global consequences.
These stories this time on the Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont. And by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Last year, only one sockeye survived the journey back to Idaho's Redfish Lake. Lonely Larry became an instant celebrity. The Bonneville Power Administration, BPA, thinks thousands of Larry's relatives end up grilled or smoked by poachers, and they've launched a massive poacher patrol operation on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. Lee Garnett climbed aboard the operation's flagship, a 56-foot cruiser sent inland on a high-tech river patrol.
0462 Lincoln Frank.
From the cabin of the Corliss, Washington State Fisheries agent Jim Brown peers through binoculars and reads a boat license. The Corliss dwarfs the small fishing boat and must be careful not to capsize it with the waves it creates.
Hi! Fish and Wildlife, how you doing today? A little bit of a wake coming, so just kind of brace yourself there for it. You guys caught any fish?
Using his binoculars, Agent Brown moves out on ship deck and checks the licenses of the two fishermen.
William, right? Was that a three-day license? What's the date on the... Okay, good. I see you got life jackets there. Got them all covered. You got a throw cushion there behind you up against your back, do you? Okay. Everything looks good.
Corliss raises the profile of fish enforcement to a new high on the Snake River. The Washington Fisheries Department normally uses it for ocean patrols. Bonneville Power commissioned the Corliss to follow adult salmon as they journey upriver to spawn.
What we've got here is a 48-mile radar with an 8-foot antenna.
Pilot Dan O'Hagan proudly profiles the high-tech equipment aboard the Corliss.
The antenna gives us the capability to pick up things even as small as a little stick on the water, birds, seagulls, just about anything. It's even so good that we can pick them up sitting on, if they're even sitting on the beach.
The Corliss also carries high-speed mini-boats the agents deploy to contact those who fish from the riverbanks. The highlight of this day's patrol is the arrest of a man for failing to show for his drunken driving trial. He was caught when agents did a routine check of his driver's license after they had charged his partner with illegally fishing for sturgeon. Agent Brown says most of the tickets they've written this week have been for license violations.
And obviously, license cases aren't our biggest concern here, but we have contacted a lot of violators that we probably wouldn't have otherwise gotten.
Anybody with salmon?
We made some salmon cases down in the Tri-Cities area that was actually made off a shore patrol that was part of this, was a collateral part of this patrol, but we didn't make any salmon cases off the Corliss.
Bonneville has a multi-million dollar public relations con program, and this is part of it.
Ed Cheney directs the Northwest Resource Information Center, an Idaho-based environmental group that frequently challenges federal agencies.
Send out people with sniper scopes and ships and planes and try to find some poor sucker who's caught one too many fish. Meanwhile, the Corps and Bonneville together are killing them by the millions.
Cheney says Bonneville Power should shift the money from salmon poaching enforcement to repairing dams.
Poaching is not the real problem. Poaching wouldn't even fall on the list of the top 100 problems. The real problem is the Army Corps of Engineers dams and the way Bonneville operates them to make money.
Cheney's group has sued Bonneville Power under the Endangered Species Law, charging the utility fails to protect Snake River salmon. But Bonneville spokeswoman Dulcie Mahar disagrees. She says Bonneville spends $300 million a year on its salmon recovery program. In addition to the anti-poaching effort, it includes habitat improvement, release of extra water during migration seasons, and better fish passage systems through its dams.
And if you do all these things and make all these investments and then they're coming back home to spawn, they're picked off, you've lost an enormous investment. So if you can spend $3 or $4 million to protect a $300 million investment, it makes a lot of sense.
Mayar says before the anti-poaching unit was funded, research indicated about 10,000 adult Snake River salmon were illegally caught every year. She says the salmon enforcement team is funded through next year, then Bonneville will assess results. But she says it appears the program is working because last year, more adult fish survived the upstream journey through eight of Bonneville's huge hydro dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. In Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Garnett.
Lee Garnett reports for the Northwest Public Affairs Network and its Regional Environmental Issues Unit. They are down there on a shelf in the dark basement, rusting away. Some are out in the garage, labels torn or obscured by grease and dust. Open the cabinet under the kitchen sink. Look, there's more. Probably every one of us has a secret stash somewhere around the house or apartment, containers of chemical herbicides, pesticides, thinners, solvents, and cleaning solutions, half-empty containers rusting away and about to leak. The Environmental Protection Agency says these are hazardous wastes. But what are we to do? Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says there is really only one way. For a demonstration, we paid him a visit recently, down in the basement, dark and damp.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Bruce, hi, what's going on?
Looks like you're, I don't know what exactly you're doing here.
Well, I'm down here in the basement of my wife's grandfather's house, and these were what I've come across as a whole flotilla here of potentially dangerous agricultural chemicals or garden chemicals. You know, 20 or 30 years ago, people would buy these chemicals, like here's one called scale rid, and here's some malathion, just an old bottle of malathion. And, you know, malathion's what they use to kill the medfly, and that created a heck of a stir out in California. And these are toxic chemical pesticides and herbicides, and a lot of people, it's surprising, a lot of people have these in their basement.
I was going to say, these are very common items that probably most people have them in their basement or garage.
Yes, and, you know, I personally do, you know, think people should not use chemicals, but the important point is that if you have chemicals in your garage or wherever you keep them, they're dangerous things and they need to be taken care of very carefully. People don't really, typically a person will move into a house or have some chemicals sitting around, and what they're going to do is they'll go, I don't want this anymore, and they'll toss it in the trash. Or they'll toss it down the drain and pour a lot of water down and flush it down. But that chemical is not going to go away. That chemical is going to stay within our little ecosphere here. If you throw it in the trash, it goes to the landfill. Eventually these cans, you can see these cans right here are starting to rust out. When it gets in the landfill, there's a good chance that they'll rust out or get run over by a big, heavy equipment, break, and those chemicals are going to leak out, and then they'll leach down into our groundwater, and they'll eventually come back, and you'll be drinking these chemicals in some form sometime along the line.
Well, let me ask you then, what is your suggestion? Short of leaving them on the shelf in the basement or your garage to rust out at home, what do you do?
Well, you first of all, you have to realize that these are considered by the EPA to be household hazardous waste. They're toxic, they're dangerous, sometimes they're explosive, not all of these, but sometimes they are, and fertilizers can be, for sure. And you've got to realize that they're hazardous waste, and you have to treat them at arm's length. You've got to find out if there is a hazardous waste collection program in your town, in your city, in your county, or your state. If you don't know about one, contact your public works department, contact an environmental group or maybe a League of Women Voters group or just the mayor's office. Call some elected official and ask them about a hazardous waste collection program. It's becoming more and more common. And then when you find out about the program, you want to carefully put these in a box. That's what I've got right here. It's a nice box, and I'm boxing these up. This is a pretty good heavy-duty box. And actually, I should probably have a pair of gloves on, and you might even want to consider wearing some goggles if some of the stuff is old and corroded. So you want to put it in a nice box, put a lid on it, and take it to the hazardous waste collection program when they tell you to come. And in between times, get it in a box, get it closed away. You don't want the kids anywhere near this stuff. You don't want them to even smell it or touch the containers, because the stuff, when misused, can be very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, treat this with tender care. Take care so you don't get yourself burned or get anything in your eye. We'll see you next time.
I know. Yes. I am going to be careful here.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. In Hollowville, New York, this is Bruce Robertson. What is the cost of a plastic picnic fork, or a foam coffee cup, or a hydroelectric dam? No, the real cost. The cost in dollars, and more importantly, in natural resources, from beginning to end. These are questions being asked anymore by science, industry, policymakers, and even by we consumers. As we ask these questions, we are conducting what is called life cycle analysis, says Bruce Vigon, a research specialist with Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio.
Life cycle analysis is a systematic procedure for analyzing the cradle-to-grave consequences of products or activities. It starts with defining all of the activities that contribute to the manufacturing, use, and disposal or recycling of a product or material, and tries to provide informed information upon which to make decisions about trade-offs in terms of alternative materials, alternative processes, alternative ways to use a product, or decisions among different products that might serve the same function.
If this is too clinical a description, Vigon suggests we use a bar of soap, not to wash up, but to study.
When I go to the store to buy a simple bar of soap, what seems to be a very simple product, I think it's not immediately apparent to people that when they buy that bar of soap, they're actually buying a whole chain of industrial operations and even going back into things like cattle raising. We get ingredients for making soap from tallow, and that comes from raising cattle, and even beyond that, up into harvesting of silage and grain and hay to feed those cattle. So this whole life cycle concept really gets you to thinking about the consequences of the industrial activities that go into making any product. And we really like to think of this as being a cradle-to-grave kind of analysis, that we try to take it back to the point of really considering getting raw materials out of the earth, whether they be petrochemical materials or agricultural products or whatever, but taking it back far enough so that the full consequences of making, using, and disposing of a product are revealed. The same thing is true in the bar soap situation. Once you use that bar of soap up, its life cycle really hasn't totally ended. You've got disposal of the packaging that the bar of soap arrived in. You've got the wastewater that's generated as a result of using the product and the treatment that ensues make sure that waterways that might be receiving that wastewater are not contaminated. So there's a whole chain of activities that extend both upstream and downstream of the place where most people use these products. And life cycle assessment helps to inform that process and make people understand what the nature of these upstream and downstream activities might entail in terms of environmental issues.
By calling this life cycle analysis, we make formal what, for increasing numbers of us, has been a private concern. Conducting such an analysis is perhaps easiest done on consumer products, but Vigon says we need not limit our thinking to items on the store shelf. Analyzing the energy field using the same tests would help us compare more accurately the costs and benefits of coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear, hydropower, solar, and wind power, where often drilling, digging, damming, and other activities are not factored into the cost of obtaining and using the power from these sources.
we look at a situation of producing electricity, for example, using traditional fuels like oil and coal, clearly the emissions that are occurring at the point of generation of the power from the power plant itself are clearly issues that need to be that people need to be made aware of and are consequences of those technologies. But as you pointed out, the collection of raw materials, the extraction of oil, the mining of coal, those are all part of producing that kilowatt hour of electricity. And conversely, for production of electricity by wind power or solar energy, while the actual production process may be relatively clean, the production of the equipment used to produce that power also entails some environmental consequences. For example, the manufacturing of the solar cells is a process that generates some solvent waste and some other waste associated with mining the materials that are made into the voltage collectors. So I think that in order to make a fairer a level playing field comparison of these different technologies, it's really necessary to lay out the flow diagram and to lay out all these activities and properly account for all of the inputs and outputs that occur at each of those steps in the chain.
For our purposes here, perhaps we can say the history of civilization is nothing if not the history of consumption, our ever-widening search for better products and methods to make life easier, safer, and stronger against our enemies and such. When human population was smaller and natural resources appeared endless, our consumption had little effect on the planet. Today, things are quite different.
In a broader philosophical sense, that we as a society have gotten a certain isolation and disconnectedness from our environment. I think up until, really until probably the late 60s and the realization of the impacts of things like Rachel Carson's publications on pesticides and some of the broader publications that have tried to connect mankind's activities to the environment as a whole, there was really an attitude that says it really didn't make any difference what humans did. The world was too big. We really couldn't exert much of an influence. Whatever we might pollute was just a very localized activity. And I think that as people have begun to use a more holistic view of things, they have realized that a lot of these small localized consequences tend to add up to broad global consequences in many cases. And I think how we get out of this is really to foster a manner of thinking that extends not only to consumers, but to manufacturers as well.
In fact, Vigon says industry is already asking important questions of itself. We need to encourage even more discussion and policy change.
We need to specifically promote policies that promote the idea that generating 5 or 10 times the volume of waste for every unit of product that you produce is no longer an acceptable way to do business. I think that the whole idea of trying to look at forging relationships among material producers, product producers, and raw material suppliers it can be a policy-driven thing that makes the production process more efficient and more environmentally sensitized.
The more passionate reformers are unwilling to leave the change in policy and procedure up to ethical motivation. There ought to be a law, some say. However, Vigon, who worked with the Environmental Protection Agency to design just such a law, is now skeptical it can be done.
I know that there's been a lot of discussion about trying to condense life cycle thinking and life cycle information into the sort of nutrition label format, and that I think is going to be a very difficult thing to do. I think that the options that have been proposed for a national labeling program or a regional state labeling scheme are going to be fairly difficult to implement. I think given the experience we've had with nutritional labels, the whole idea of trying to provide equal comparisons and proper benchmarks is tough, but I think consumers can be more informed. They can take advantage of those 800 numbers that you see on the back of packages to ask manufacturers about the environmental attributes of their products or their packages. If you see a package that that you think is environmentally unsound, I think that information needs to be communicated back to manufacturers. They do take action when they get that kind of feedback from consumers.
Just as change in the status quo must be affected at the industry and consumer level, there also must be change in the regulatory process at the governmental level.
I think we're going to see and need to see two directions. I don't think the old approach of command and control and really sort of putting a regulation in place that says you have to do things this way is the way to go. I think given the experience of the past several years in terms of voluntary and cooperative incentive-based programs is really, from a regulatory standpoint, the approach that I think is going to be the most effective. And I also see policies and decisions that are driven lower in the government hierarchy. Instead of the federal government coming across and saying you have to do it this way, I see more evidence of these kinds of incentives and programs being responded to at the state and even the municipality level. I think some of the larger municipalities in terms of trying to use some of these life cycle concepts for even some of their government procurements, office paper, towels, and so on, are really going to try to modify the system that they use to make those decisions.
Wherever decisions are made, logic and common sense must prevail. These, combined with a careful study of the exact details of the situation. Consider, for example, recycling a glass jar of, let's say, peanut butter. In many communities, the regulation says the glass must not only be clean, the labels must be removed. Okay, fine, you say, but wait, are we saving a glass container at the expense of all that water going down the drain as we soak and clean the bottle? In the end, how much of the environment have we really saved?
I think it's fair to say that a lot of life cycle studies that have been done on things like glass recycling have shown that up to a certain point, that recycling is both an energy and material resource benefiting activity, that we should be doing that as a society. But there are circumstances, particularly on a local basis, where in, for example, a water short area or an area that's located fairly far from recycling facilities where the glass can be turned back into bottles, that one can actually see a reversal, and what was a net benefit now becomes an environmental cost. So from a consumer's perspective, I think that it's important for them to try to stay informed and ask these kinds of questions. Why is the need there to perform all this extensive cleaning? Are there other alternatives that the solid waste recycler might find that would eliminate or at least reduce the need for the extensive cleaning? So I think it's a communication process, and the consumer needs to try to get information upon which to raise consciousness, maybe even on the part of the municipality or the recycler, that things that might not have been thought about in terms of making a decision about what the consumer is being asked to do.
Bruce Vigon, a process engineer at Patel Memorial Institute, Columbus, Ohio. Studies on products and processes have been done in recent years. Nearly all of them are either inconclusive or, worse, conflicting. Paper is better than plastic. No, plastic is better than paper. In the meantime, the EPA is working to establish national standards, and Green Seal, a nonprofit organization based in Washington to rate consumer products and affix a green seal on those deemed safe for the environment. The first of these will be appearing on store shelves very soon. Until we establish an external code to rate everything, life cycle analysis will be more of an internal awareness process. Look around you and think of the life cycle of the couch in your living room, a box of cereal in the kitchen, the glass in the headlights of your car, the concrete on the sidewalk downtown. Any of it came from somewhere and will go somewhere, eventually. For now, this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We had help from the Environmental Issues Unit from the Northwest Public Affairs Network. Next week, on the road, at home at a solar energy house, and a hike through Black Rock Forest, a sustainable growth forest. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 190. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.